Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, and I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm peachy.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
Many thanks, as always, to those of you who are listening to this on Tuesday for helping us keep this whole thing sustainable. If you're listening on Wednesday, you know, consider signing up. Listening on Tuesday is so much more fun. The chat room is hopping. The comments section is roiling with dissent and some praise and whatnot. And if you didn't get Thursday's episode about the Goonerpocalypse, I can't really describe what you're missing out on. I have to say I'm a little disturbed is maybe the word for how many people did sign up just to see that episode. But, you know, it's
grateful.
It's in
We're
a good way.
Grateful.
It's a good way. Yeah, no, sure. Very grateful. But you do need to see it, too. The audio doesn't really do the whole thing. justice, but that Too Hot for Network episode really is only available if you sign up for a subscription. We're not giving that one away for free just because of the career implications. But now, enough of the shilling. On to the controversies and non-troversies. Taylor Sheridan, the guy who almost single-handedly turned Paramount Plus from an also-ran into a hit streaming service, is leaving the streamer in 3 years or so. He's going to be gone. Donna Langley over at Universal poached him from the newly Ellison-owned Paramount for an enormous overall deal for both film and TV / streaming. The film deal starts in March, runs for 8 years. There's some question as to, you know, who gets first look on his screenplays, that sort of thing. But the TV deal starts in 3 years. And until then, Sheridan will continue to run everything that he's running over at the Mountain logo. I do think it's worth dwelling on the importance of Sheridan to Paramount for just a moment, because I think folks don't necessarily appreciate how key he has been to the network and its success. Indeed, I think most folks still think of Paramount Plus as an also-ran in the streaming wars, but the network really has rattled off a series of genuine hits over the last few years. You got Billy Bob Thornton in Landman, you've got Sly Stallone in Tulsa King, you've got Nicole Kidman and Lioness. They've all done huge numbers for the service. And according to some data from Antenna, provided to Matthew Bellany, those three shows drove more signups for Paramount Plus than anything else the streamer has done. Wow. And this is before we consider the many Yellowstone spinoffs that litter the service, though, of course, not the original show itself, which streams on Universal's Peacock due to a weird rights deal. That's neither here nor there. In a universe where intellectual property was thought to be the gold standard, was the king of streaming, the streaming wars, it's not Star Trek that has driven Paramount Plus into the conversation. It's not Mission Impossible. It's not the franchises they own. But it's a series of original, kind of soapy, procedural-ish type shows that all kind of sort of fit into that Yellowstone mold. All of those shows have made Nielsen streaming charts in a way that nearly nothing from Paramount used to. It's a big deal. That's a big deal, which is why it was a mild shock that Paramount was willing to let Sheridan walk. Now, only a mild shock for a handful of reasons. One of them, some inside baseball stuff about Ellison sweeping out the executives who worked most closely with Sheridan. Another is that Sheridan shows are kind of expensive. He spends a lot of money. The new Paramount regime has decided that cost cutting is the order of the day. And then there's the MAGA of it all. Sheridan has repeatedly said he doesn't see his TV output as particularly conservative, even as he has been proclaimed as kind of this bard of the heartland. One wonders what he makes of the Ellison family's closeness to Donald Trump and all that. Signing creatives to big overall deals is kind of hit and miss. For every Shonda Rhimes at Netflix, you get a J.J. Abrams at Warner Brothers or Phoebe Waller-Bridge at Amazon. But Sheridan is sui generis in one very key way, which is that he is not really just an overseer like Dick Wolf, who is very prodigious. He is both prodigious and an actual writer. He's cranking out tons of scripts. He's not writing every script, but he writes a lot of them. He does serious polishes on the ones he doesn't wholly write. And he seems to be a real idea machine. I mean, I think he still is on the hook for two or three more original series at Paramount Plus, and nobody seems to think he's going to have any trouble with that. I do find this all kind of interesting, just on an artistic level, because Sheridan seems to have found that sweet spot merging traditional network TV procedural type shows with the slightly fancier prestige TV. Peter, why wouldn't Paramount fight tooth and nail to keep this guy on board?
Because he's expensive and you can't say no to him. And that seems like it's really the core thing here. So there's a whole bunch of issues, but the whole thing with Taylor Sheridan is no one questions his budgets and no one questions his creative decisions. That has been his deal pretty much from day one, from the start of when he started Yellowstone and then built out the expanded Taylor Sheridan universe. There was a story that I heard. This is like it might have been from a Twitter response section. So I'm going to say that this is a story.
So it's 100% factual truth.
And it's definitely 100% factually true. I cannot verify the story, but that there was when he was pitching Yellowstone after it, he had taken it from HBO, because something people forget is that show was developed first at HBO. HBO said, this is a little too heartland for us. Basically, this doesn't fit our audience and our sense of what HBO is. Crazy. But they let him take the show somewhere else. And when he was pitching it, the story that I heard was he was like, okay, I guess I'll take this pitch meeting. But here's the rules. You're going to fly me out on a private jet. I'm going to walk into the meeting, give you my pitch. You don't say anything. And then you can say one thing after that, yes or no. And the deal is, if you say yes, no notes ever. And that is like, so no studio interference. You just then have to say yes to whatever he wants to do after that. That is the story I heard. Now, whether or not that is perfectly technically true, this kind of captures the Taylor Sheridan vibe. And David Ellison started his tenure at Paramount by saying no to Taylor Sheridan on a couple of things. They turned down, reportedly, the Wall Street Journal has this, they turned down a feature film script, said, we don't want to make this, which Sheridan took as some kind of insult. They started questioning his budgets. Shows like Lioness run something like $20 million per episode. I mean, it's got, Zoe Saldana and Nicole Kidman, as stars in this, right? They also put Nicole Kidman in another show without telling him, which irked him apparently, right? Like they're using his resources. And so he just looked at this and said, my deal is I do whatever I want. You're not going to honor that way of doing things. And look, he's somebody who can go and get another deal, a gigantic deal somewhere else. The Journal also reported that if the shows that he creates for NBC, through this deal that starts in 2029, if they perform as well as they hope, this deal could be worth $1 billion to him. And so this is an opportunity for him to retain creative control, to make possibly even more money. And then the other thing is to go to someplace that is at this point a little bit smaller and not involved in the merger wars and in the politics of all of that. And that's going to make him more powerful inside the institution that he's in, because he is going to be the biggest fish in a somewhat smaller pond.
Yeah, he already had that, though. It's interesting. My understanding is that Netflix was never really in the mix for Sheridan services because, he he would just be another cog in the giant Netflix machine. You know, he would just be a guy who is there for work, and he doesn't want to be that way. He wants to be the big fish in the small pond. Alyssa, what do you make of the kind of secondary politics of it all? I would not want to go out on a limb here and say like he was like, oh god, these Ellisons, they love Trump so much. I don't think that was it, but I do wonder if there was some, you know, kind of worry there that the network is going to get bogged down in lots of stuff he doesn't want to get bogged down in.
Yeah, I mean, and in keeping with what Peter's just said, I mean, this is not a guy who makes compromises. And to get this deal done, the Ellisons made a lot of compromises, right? And Sheridan may have looked at that and said, okay, is this going to run up? I mean, is this going to end up in a scenario where I'm not just told no, but told no about something for a reason that I think is just like egregious and stupid and embarrassing. And at present, there's less risk of that at MSNBC because they're not in sort of the merger game at the moment. That can always change. Although I guess if he's going over there in 2029, there's going to be another president, maybe with a different attitude towards all of this. Who knows how to wish cast this out or wish cast, forecast, whatever cast. But I mostly think it's funny, right? It's like, you know, you lose the guy who has sort of given you kind of the Heartland vibe that everyone else is trying to imitate, whether that's sort of Netflix's Hunting Wives, Secret Lives of Hunting Wives.
I mean, not just the Heartland vibe, the Heartland audience. And his shows are, in fact, this is not just a myth. His shows are, in fact, hugely popular in red states. And Yellowstone in particular had a completely had a very unusual pattern of adoption where it was much smaller metros like Kansas City and kind of, you know, middle of the country red states that adopted that show first before it sort of spread out to the coasts.
Yes, indeed. So I think it's amusing that, you know, a company that is, you know, sort of talking certainly in the way it's now running its news division and elsewhere about sort of winning trust, winning audiences elsewhere, apparently was unable to hold on to the person who was kind of leading them in that direction in the first place. You know, I also just think it's this is interesting for a number of reasons, because unlike a bunch of the other creators of big hits, Sheridan doesn't really have acolytes, right? Like there aren't people who have sort of worked with him on these shows. In fact, he was very resistant to the idea that, you know, there should be sort of minimum writer's room staffing levels because he really just wants to write all of this stuff himself, or at least, you know, do, as you said, Peter, sort of heavy polishes. And, you know, if you look at someone like Shonda Rhimes, you know, she has built up a number of writers and showrunners who kind of now operate out of her ambit. George Pelicanos has done a lot of work with David Simon and writes episodes, if not sort of runs shows individually. Michael Patrick King and Darren Star collaborated on a lot of Sex and the City. You often have someone with a partner or sort of a strong number two. Who then can either step up and become the showrunner while the original showrunner goes off to other projects. And so, you know, there isn't even someone who I know of who can kind of pick up the Sheridan mantle at Paramount and continue developing and running similar things successfully. It's also a risk, right? I mean, tastes change. And it may be that in 3 or 5 years, audiences are not as interested in the kind of, you know, sort of modern Westerns that Sheridan does so well. And so, you know, I can see a scenario where he puts some of this stuff on, you know, just regular NBC and it's a huge hit. Or I can see a scenario where he doesn't come close to earning out that $1 billion, right? It's, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's kind of performance based. So I don't think he is.
Totally.
Yeah.
I mean, he's going to make a lot of money no matter what.
100%. But he's not necessarily going to make $1 billion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I just want to say the point about taste is interesting, but I do think it, I think the one kind of real key that makes Sheridan so valuable is that he has kind of cracked that weird, that there does seem to be some sort of code of like, how do you do TV? But make it not quite TV, but make it still recognizably TV. And that is what all of the Yellowstone spinoffs are. That is what all the, you know, that's what Tulsa King and the Jeremy Renner, you know, show is, where he's running the prison town. I can't remember. There's so many shows. The Sheridan verse is so enormous.
I haven't seen the man, Jeremy Renner
the
one.
The man has a ranch to fund, right? Like he.
This is actually the other thing, is he clearly likes to work, right? This is a guy who is writing dozens of television shows solo and polishing even more each year. But he also now has this like truly unique, gigantic ranch that he owns. That like part of the reason he initially struck up the deal with Paramount to do all of these shows, not just to do Yellowstone and be rich, you know, in the way of like making $10 or $20 million a year kind of rich. He needed to make hundreds of millions of dollars to fund this ranch that he has. You said something about him not having acolytes, Alyssa, that I thought was interesting. And that's a really good point. And I think actually that goes to the thing that I was talking about, which is that he doesn't like to hear no. It's not even just that he doesn't like to hear no. He doesn't want to haggle. He doesn't want to have bureaucracy where he has to take a meeting about whether or not we're going to have 100 cows in the background of this shot, because that's going to cost more. He just wants to do it because it's all him. He's not working with a team. I mean, he is working with a team, but creatively, he's just working inside his own head, and he decides what they're going to do, and then they do it. And I think this is actually a big thing for him, is he just doesn't want to have anybody else be involved in that process, because he is somebody who reportedly sometimes just goes away into a little room for an hour and a half and writes 1 hour of television entirely by himself, and then basically doesn't do any revisions on it. And he wants to retain the optionality to not have to go through a bureaucratic process. And it really seems like Ellison is trying to push him into a bureaucratic process about both the creative and about the budget, and he doesn't like that.
I'm excited for Taylor Sheridan's first Peacock show, which is about a tough loner writer who just wants to write his own words. He's tired of the man.
Do you think there's a Taylor Sheridan LLM? Like, do you think he's going to invest in a company that just like lets him generate all of the realistic cows that he wants, so like no one can ever tell him no? We're gonna end up with 500. We're gonna end up with peak Taylor Sheridan with her like 512 Taylor Sheridan shows.
There is a very recognizable style to his dialogue across shows, across characters, and the recognizable style is actually he's just writing modern day Red State Aaron Sorkin dialogue. It's all pitter patter, where you know you've got the smart person who's explaining how the world works, and it sort of resolves into a monologue. And there's like a quip. And quip, and they're back and forth, and it's not quite the walking and talking thing, but it's just remarkable the extent. Once you see it, and it's especially true with Landman, but once you see it, you cannot unsee the way that he is just taking Aaron Sorkin's stylistic tics and then executing them in Red State settings. They are often about bureaucracy, about the law, about these sort of political ideas. They have these kind of really smug pat monologues that just end with like a, you know, you stupid lib, you're getting owned for not understanding that this is how the world works. It's just Aaron Sorkin, but in reverse. This is why people like it, because Aaron Sorkin is, in fact, good. He was just and he also had that same problem with like apps, writing everything himself, turning in all of his scripts late, having huge problems with bureaucracy, the creative and the budget bureaucracy with his shows. He was not as prolific, was not able to actually execute and get it all done in the same way, but very, very similar.
All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that we will have a peak Taylor Sheridan, where a series of gray goo bots take over the entire world and turn it into farmland for Landman shows? Alyssa.
Controversy. Look, of course, it's controversial when you have one of these mega deals that actually has worked out and then you can't hold on to the person.
Peter.
It's news, but I don't think it's controversial, actually. This is just a top-tier creative taking advantage of the fact that he's in demand. And the thing about Taylor Sheridan and LLMs is he's not going to need one, because he's the only human being in Hollywood whose output actually rivals ChatGPT.
I will say, well, it's a controversy. This is just the business of Hollywood, but it is, it is fascinating. I would honestly be curious to poll other showrunners and to see how many of them would actually prefer to work his way or with their writers' rooms. Because I think the sense I get is that most writers find what he does to be like kind of baffling and vaguely intimidating, and also like kind of selfish. Like, I know this was a big thing during the union, during the strike and everything. The people were like annoyed that he was pushing back against these minimum writers' rooms. They were like, "Well, you should want more. You should want there to be more jobs." And he's just like, "I don't want. I just want to write my words. I just want to write my words in my
alone.
Room."
He wants to be he wants to be a billion-dollar TV creator who has the license and freedom of a Substacker.
And also
that is the literal dream. That's what who doesn't want that? That's what we all want. All right.
Subscribe to Across the Movie Aisle so I can buy one cow.
If we become billionaire Substackers, I guarantee you we will make at least one Taylor Sheridan verse show. All right, make sure to swing over to movieaisle.substack.com, where we're going to be discussing a recent paper that suggests that cable news networks hit on culture war topics as a means of gaining viewership. Well, okay, that's not rocket science, but it does in turn kind of lead to a vicious cycle, which places more importance on culture war stuff, which in turn leads to politicians emphasizing that, which in turn leads to important issues being ignored, rinse and repeat, et cetera, et cetera. And now,
folks,
on to
what we're going
to
talk about is news gooners.
News gooners. That's right. I mean, it's rage bait, so to speak. All right. We're going to go on to the main event now. On to the main event, which is Begonia.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger fuel centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Begonia, the latest provocation from Yorgos Lanthimos, the director of the Oscar-winning Poor Things and The Favourites and indie darlings like The Lobster and The Killing of a Sacred Deer. Begonia asks an important question. What if all the problems you personally face aren't of your own making or due to bad luck or something else, but because evil aliens from the Andromeda Galaxy were conspiring to make your life worse? What if? I don't know. Maybe it's true. That is at least what Teddy Gatz, who is played by Jesse Plemons, believes has gone wrong with his life. As he tells his autistic cousin, Don, who's played by Aiden Delbus, Andromedans have come to our planet to turn us into docile hive creatures, not unlike bees, which Teddy and Don cultivate. So we can be dominated by the aliens. He's been doing some research all on his own, you see. He's figured it out what they're all up to. Teddy and Don are going to kidnap Michelle Fuller, who's played by Emma Stone, the girl boss CEO of a major pharmaceutical corporation whose drugs have put Teddy's mom into a coma, so she can take them up to the Andromedan mothership during the upcoming lunar eclipse to negotiate a truce. I see zero problems with this plan. Full disclosure, this is probably my favorite of Lanthimos's films. I don't love him as a director or as a writer, and this movie is the kind of best combination of his dyspeptic view of human life with his black sense of humor and his own stylistic quirks. It's in line with a series of movies that have come out this year: Eddington, After the Hunt, One Battle After Another. Insofar as it is a movie about, it's about our moment, about how we got to this place where everyone has gone a little bit crazy. The movie it is closest to is probably Eddington, at least in the sense that it concerns the way in which social media can circumvent mainstream media and have an undue impact on the emotionally unbalanced. This makes some sense since the two films share some creatives. Eddington's Ari Aster is a producer on Begonia, while Begonia's writer Will Tracy is a producer on Eddington. Emma Stone, of course, stars in both, though her presence in Eddington is much more minor than her work here. And both are also outwardly kind of leftist films. I don't feel too uncomfortable saying that. Begonia, like Eddington, is a movie that's at least in part about the idea that ideology and the education of the individual matters little in the face of the complete and utter social, the complete and utter corporate political domination of society. At one point, Teddy notes that he did a speed run through all the ideologies of the day, from alt-light to alt-right to leftist to socialist. He found them all kind of empty. It wasn't until he realized that his life was completely and utterly controlled by the corporate hegemony of Fuller's Axolith Pharmaceuticals that he could break the cycle and truly make a change. And there's this great scene in the movie where Emma Stone's character tries to explain how her importance as this pharmaceutical executive will lead to the mobilization of all of the police forces in the region and the federal government. And they're all going to come crashing down on our poor little guys here. So they should probably just give up right now. You know, I don't know, or you could Maybe they're right. Again, maybe they're right. Maybe it's aliens. Maybe it's aliens, or maybe they're just terrorizing an innocent lady executive who wants nothing more than to wake up at 4:30, do some Krav Maga, tell her office drones that they should strongly consider leaving at 5:30. Seriously, just go home at 5:30. You know, unless you have work to do, make sure you do your work, but also leave at 5:30. And it is just this perfect. That whole sequence is this just perfect. Amazing. Little corporate joke that you really have to experience to understand. Again, this is also broadly is the point of Eddington. It's a movie that posits the crushing forces of techno-capitalism mean more than any simple right-left divide on the political or cultural level. And I've seen people describe Astor's movie, Eddington, as centrist, quote, centrist, end quote, because it doesn't spare identity politics, liberals, or center-left politicians from its ire. But the point of the both sides-ism in that film isn't that both sides are equal or equally bad, more that neither of them really offers a solution to the problems faced by the characters in the film. Both Eddington and Begonia are, I mentioned this in the chat, and I think Peter may have had a stroke. But I think they both fall under a category we might call Chapo Trap House cinema. And I'm not saying that just because Astor is a listener of that elder millennial Bernie Bro podcast or that he's been on it. It's just that's kind of the vibe. These movies give off the vibes of that podcast. Alyssa, one thing I've actually found interesting is that conservative film critics have, by and large, liked Eddington and Begonia, despite this description that I've just had. You know, Kyle Smith of The Wall Street Journal and I are two of the very few Rotten Tomatoes certified critics who consider themselves to be conservative on some level. We're both in sync here. Not always the case, but we are here. And I get the sense that you were a little bit more skeptical about both of these films than we were. Do you find that split surprising at all? I'm a little bit surprised by it.
That's interesting. I don't know that I am skeptical of either film as sort of a well-made work of art. I think it's just, look, I am the sunny optimist on this podcast in a lot of ways, right?
Like, you're optimistic nature, about like, sunny.
The sunny hyphen optimist. You'll turn it around, Sunny. I believe in you.
I am optimistic about Sunny. But no, I'm the person who basically believes that like human beings are good and that we can make things better if we want to. And, you know, maybe we'll come around to wanting to. And so there's sort of a chilly pessimism in both of those movies that is just not who I am personally, right? Like that is not my vibe. But I have been thinking about both of those movies and a bunch of other stuff this year and sort of thinking that this is the year in art that the normie started to wake up and that like normiedom kind of reasserted itself. Because part of what I find interesting and effective about Begonia and at times like very funny and interesting is the parallels between Michelle and Teddy, right? You know, there is this opening sequence where Teddy is sort of putting Don through this training regimen that's intended to prepare them to kidnap Michelle. Michelle is doing her sort of regular morning routine. And like, they're both doing yoga. They're both doing sort of, you know, cardio stuff. I mean, they're, you know, Teddy and Don are doing like, you know, half-assed calisthenics while Michelle is like running on a fancy-ass treadmill with like an oxygen mask on or something. But they are, and you know, they're both caught up in various kinds of sort of scripted speak, right? The running joke with Michelle, just sort of trying to tell people to leave at 5:30, even though she doesn't really want them to, including like the valet who she's, you know, getting her car keys from. You know, and Teddy is sort of going through these like hype up scripts about, you know, how Don's actually really a hero. And, you know, and they're both sides of the equation are to a certain are nuts on some level, right? Like, you know, Michelle has vanished so far into corporate speak that she's like totally divorced from the human experience in certain ways. You know, she has done, as it turns out, kind of really terrible things in pursuit of, you know, drug development and just kind of talking herself into them. Those sort of parallels between her and Elizabeth Holmes are, I think, you know, sort of put to very good aesthetic use here. And, you know, Teddy at the same time is caught up in this way of thinking that for much of the movie, you know, the script suggests is insane. They both have gotten just sort of so far away from actual human experience by going in totally different directions, right? It's like, you know, if you go far enough around, you sort of come in a circle. And their varying types of insanity end up having terrible consequences for all of the, you know, just normal everyday citizens of Earth, right? You know, I don't want to spoil the ending exactly, but there is like a long series of, you know, almost sort of painterly shots at the end of the movie that are just like, this is what happened to everybody else who is not caught up in this nonsense as a result of this nonsense. And, you know, Eddington is sort of a story about what happens when like there's nobody sane left in a town, right? When everybody's brains are just completely melted by the isolation and stress of the pandemic and social media. You know, there's just an interesting current running through all of these movies about the differences between their sort of insane protagonists and real life. And, you know, the resurgence of the normies is kind of happening in the negative in the back of all of these movies. But I do think that it is interesting that you have this series of, you know, and I think One Battle After Another kind of doesn't fit into the schema quite as well. But you have this series of sort of chilly movies set in kind of hermetically sealed environments, right? Like a town in lockdown, the ivory tower, Teddy's basement, where people are just acting incredibly weird. And the movies themselves are sort of chilling and off-putting. And I left all of them being like, none of that, please and thank you, right? Like, I am not this person. There is sort of these movies almost intentionally create distance between the viewer and the protagonist that I found left me really sort of craving like the reassertion of like common sense and normality. And I'm just finding it an interesting thread in the year. And maybe that's why, Sunny, you know, you're seeing critics like you and Kyle kind of take up these movies. It's like, let's just all stop being insane on the internet, in our corporations, in our chat rooms. Like, what would it be like to be normal again?
I do think I think at least part of it is a respect for seeing movies from a genuine point of view, even if it's not one we necessarily agree with or identify with. But yeah, just to see somebody be like, all right, this is what all of this has led to, and it's bad. Again, I think it's interesting. I don't know. I don't have a better word for it than it being interesting. I just find it. I find it all. It's always interesting to me when that sort of thing happens. Peter, what did you make of Begonia?
I loved this movie. The more I think about it, the more I love it. This is the ultimate both sides movie about our cultural divide, right? Because this is a movie about the sort of, in extremis, the two parts of America, the kind of lower class, poor, disheveled, self-educated, working in a fulfillment center, you know, just sort of at completely outside of any kind of elite experience, Teddy. And then we have this, you know, the corporate elite who is who actually runs the company for the fulfillment center that he works at, right? Who is this absolutely poised, perfect, completely precise person who speaks in a language that, as Alyssa put it, is just like divorced from any kind of real human language. It is so corporatified. So like, even when she's criticizing the DEI speak at the beginning of the film, she's doing so in a way that doesn't seem quite human. And this is the movie's like genius idea, is those people these are like two alien species. They cannot talk to each other. And this is a movie that like just gets at in a great kind of dramatic metaphorical conceit. This is a movie that gets at why it is so difficult right now for people in America, and maybe in the rest of the world too, but certainly in America, to understand each other, because it is about their lack of a common language, even though, as Alyssa says, they are kind of going through these like inverted versions of the same motions, training the same way, sort of both, you know, she spends a huge amount of time, on her, a computer, et cetera, right? Like there is this sense that they are in some sense the same, but they are also totally unable to speak to each other. And the whole second act of this film, right? So the plot is, as you said, Sonny, right? Like he and his neurodivergent cousin kidnap her. But the whole second act is basically just in the basement and then in their house, right? At where she's been kidnapped, her head has been shaved. She is their captive. And she goes through the motions of trying to find different ways to talk to him. And so first she's just like, I'm important. They're going to come for you. This is futile. And she's basically trying to do a sort of negotiation from a position of power. Well, that doesn't work, right? But that's the thing. That's the first thing she goes to, because that's how she operates in her life as the head of a giant corporation, is I'm important. You're not. Let me tell you how this is. I think she even says this is how it's going to be. Well, it's not that way. So next, she starts talking to him about, you know, how he's hurt, right? He's got mental issues, right? He's gone down rabbit holes. He's been misled by the internet, by conspiracy theories. And like, he's just like, yeah, I've read the New York Times pieces too, right? I can like cite the think pieces, like, don't talk to me like that. Yeah. Because, and you see, it's incredibly condescending when she does this. The way when she speaks to him, like she's diagnosing him like a pundit from the media, and he doesn't like it, and he just dismisses her. He is familiar with all of this, right? And so then she tries to talk to him a little bit more, almost like equals, you know. And you get this whole bit about how he's moved through all of the politics, right? And it is just this sort of progression of these are the tactics that elites who are separated from maybe not ordinary people. I don't think Teddy is exactly ordinary, but separated people, but elites who are separated from a lot of the rest of the country and a lot of the rest of the world. And it dramatizes it in a way that is, to me, like just so juicy and like riveting and engaging. I just could not, like, this is a movie that kept me wrapped with attention. I just, like, this was not one where I was checking my watch. This was not one where I was sort of like, oh, I can see where this is going. Let's just get, like, I just wanted to sort of sit with these scenes and let them play out. And it's really nicely paced in this way, right? And that whole second act is basically, yes, we have our third character with the cousin. There is a cop who shows up. There's some other, but it is basically a two-hander, just this dialogue between two people who are both humans in America, who occupy completely different but highly interrelated stations. Their lives cannot exist without each other, and yet they have absolutely no idea how to have any kind of conversation at all, because their realities are fundamentally different. And so the way that this movie, both sides, is these folks is the thing that I love about it most. It doesn't just, like, it fundamentally, it kind of says both of them are right about each other. Teddy really is crazy. He really is, in some sense, right? He has gone down an internet rabbit hole and gotten all these bizarre ideas in his head, and he has kidnapped a person and is acting violently. And then also she really is like an alien, totally unable to relate to a normal human being in a normal way, because she's completely divorced from any kind of normal experience.
Peter, I want to, one, you briefly mentioned the police character who's played by Stavros, famous podcaster, been on a bunch of TV shows, comedy guy. My kids know him as the guy from the Fireball ads during sporting events. So that's a nice little bonus. But the
Fireball the whiskey, not Fireball the candies.
Fireball the whiskey.
Yeah.
What's interesting about that character is that he kind of parachutes in, and you think he's going to be like the antagonistic cop, and instead he is apologizing for, I guess, some mild spoiler here. We'll get into bigger spoilers in a minute. He's apologizing for, as best as I can tell, sexually assaulting Jesse Plemons as a child.
Yep.
And you know, this is a guy who lives in a universe in which his mother was addicted to opioids and who took a drug to get unaddicted from opioids that gave her brain death.
And whose father is completely absent. I mean, we get one reference to him. I wouldn't recognize him if I saw him, is what the Plemons character says, basically.
Exactly. And this is, I think, what is most interesting about the characterization of the character of the character that Plemons plays in this movie, is that it's a deeply sad.
Yeah.
Portrait of a person, and like, this movie is very funny. I it's kind of like Poor Things, which I liked much less than this, but Poor Things made me laugh out loud about a dozen times despite not really liking that movie. This movie also made me laugh out loud despite the fact that it's deeply sad. It's a portrait of a person who is living in a society that has essentially discarded him and has nothing for him. And he tries to find his own path, and that sadness, that real empathy that I think the movie has for him, is what grounds it and makes it compelling drama. Because I don't think there's a version of this movie that treats him as a joke and hates him and like kind of laughs at him. And this movie laughs at him a little bit, but this is
the genius of this film. This is in fact why I liked this movie so much, is that in so many ways it does treat him as a joke. You can't help but laugh at him. You can't help but think of him as a ridiculous, disheveled kind of like a character. You sort of have empathy for him, but also like this is not someone who you would give the time of day if you kind of had some interaction with him. The movie does not spare him that. It doesn't try to make him sort of, oh, we're going to treat him tenderly and sort of And yet it also doesn't make him just a punchline. It doesn't make him just the ridiculous internet guy. It gives him, it says basically, if your life was like this, you'd be cracked too. You're still cracked, but you would be cracked.
Can we talk about, can we get spoilery here? Because I think it's sort of necessary to loop up this part of the conversation.
Yes. At this point, we will be discussing the ending of the film Begonia. So if you have not seen Begonia and you would like to see Begonia without having it spoiled for you, you should stop listening now and we will come back to this.
And you should not have this movie spoiled.
Yeah. Both of you have said something that gets us sort of halfway to why the movie works, right? Which is that, you know, you do end up, the movie gives you plenty of reason to have enormous sympathy for Teddy, just sort of as a human being who has suffered enormously. And even though Michelle doesn't have sort of the same backstory, you do see her suffer in captivity, right? I mean, she is tortured. She is, you know, she is electrocuted. She is left without food. Her head is shaved. Like that, you know, I mean, her clothes are taken away. Like they leave her with her jacket, but like they've clearly stripped her naked. She's shackled. But even though the movie gives you plenty of reasons to be deeply sympathetic to both characters, it is also clear that both of them have done enormous harm, right? I mean, towards the end of the movie, Michelle, trying to make her way out of this basement, you know, takes sort of a wrong turn and discovers a chamber. Like Teddy has been murdering and dismembering people, right? Like there are corpses in his basement. Like she is not the first person that he has kidnapped and tormented and dissected in search of what he thinks is an Andromedon, right? Like he is a straight up crazy serial killer.
Well, people
And this is the big twist.
Actual aliens, because Michelle is not just actually an Andromedon. She is like the emperor of the entire society. And at the end of the movie, Teddy was right about the whole thing. But Michelle goes back to her spaceship, basically declares that humanity is not worth saving, and kills everyone on the planet. And, you know, I was referring to this sort of this series of painterly shots at the end of the movie. It is painterly shots of dead bodies, right? It is, you know, a bride on her wedding day. It is the crew of a ship. It is a group of worshipers at a mosque, and they're all just dead where, you know, Michelle popped the bubble on their civilization. And I think this is what is powerful about the movie, is not just the sense of sympathy, but the sense of responsibility, right? These are people who together have done immense damage. Like, Teddy has committed a series of grisly personal murders, and Michelle kills an entire species. And that's sort of the negative space that I find so interesting in the movie, right? It's like, all of these people are destroyed by these two extreme outliers to their own civilization, one who of whom is literally an alien, the other of whom is a moral alien to sort of the codes that surround him. And, you know, Teddy is completely right to be angry at the world that has dealt him this particular wretched hand. And Michelle, given her recent experience, like, you know, has had an experience where she's like, yep, this is not going to work. This is not, you know, their particular mental weather is understandable, but totally indefensible, right? I mean, it is in both cases completely anti-human. And again, it's like, I think that series of shots at the end is important because, like, none of these people got any say in what happened to them, right? Like, you know,
Dakota, their fate is breathtaking and beautiful, and like, it's, I'm still thinking about it, and it does the thing that the rest of the movie does too. It manages to be funny at times. I mean, there are some absurdist shots that you cannot help it but laugh at this, like, this horrific tableau of sort of weird humanity. But it also, in every one of those shots, allows that the people who are dead, that they had real lives that mattered and dignity. And
they were in the middle of those lives, right? Like, they were...
I mean, how many other directors can manage a tonal balance like that? Yorgos Lanthimos cannot usually manage a tonal balance like that. No. And it works here.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting that you say all this, Alyssa, though. The real lesson of the movie, and again, maybe drawing it back to the kind of trap house cinema idea, is that the crazy guy who listened to the podcasts and who existed outside of the realm of common decency and outside of the realm of normal conversation, who is aware of the Atlantic think pieces and yet rejects them, was right all along, and that the alien menace needs to be destroyed before it destroys. I like the real lesson of this movie, just the language of the film itself, is he should have gone on the ship and blown it up. He should have, because if he had done that, then the entire world would not have died. But he didn't do it, and the world did die.
He wasn't planning to go on the ship to blow it up. The suicide vest was basically if she tried anything funny. And yeah, a thing he was going to try and negotiate with them.
Yeah. Okay. But I don't think this guy's getting on the ship in a suicide vest without the intention of, frankly, destroying them all. Like, I don't like.
He is not the person I would tap to lead humanity. At core, is what I'm saying.
Sure,
right? I don't know. Like, of course, you can get an ambassadorship pretty easily these days. I understand.
Of course, if the mainstream believed in the Andromedans, though, he wouldn't be necessary. He would not be necessary. He has done terrible things. Yes, he has a few human bodies in his basement. But he also has a couple of Andromedan bodies.
Two Andromedans. Two Andromedans, yeah.
two Andromedans and some number of humans. But you know, these are small price to pay. You know, you got cracking the eggs to make the obviously this is all absurd and silly, but yeah. I think the very clear text of the movie is that he is right. He's just right. And whether or not he is justified in what he has done, he was correct to have done it. And that, I think, is perhaps the most disquieting element of the movie.
We're running long enough that I don't think we could do this on this podcast, but I think you can make a case that Emma Stone's character is the one who is in the right here, that her experience with humanity shows how depraved and bizarre they can be, and that in fact the whole thing, you know, it was nice while it lasted, but like, it's time to start over. And there is this movie, as I said to you guys, as I said on Twitter, reminded me of Fight Club. And Fight Club does not end with, you know, total catastrophe for all human beings, but it ends basically with wiping the slate clean of all credit, blowing up all these buildings, right? It is a sort of rebirth through apocalypse. And while I don't want to say that it is the necessary reading, I think you could construct a reading that is consistent with the film in which this movie is saying, look, humanity, nice experiment, but clearly just wasn't working out. And that tableau at the end, part of the dignity that it, like I said, it gives them dignity, but it also makes you it also renders every one of those people who is dead a little bit absurd and a little bit ridiculous. Like this is humanity.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Begonia? Peter?
Loved it. Thumbs up. One of the better movies I've seen this year.
Alyssa?
Thumbs up on a craft level, but I think humanity is worth saving. Maybe I'm wrong.
That's what an alien trying to convince us that you're not an alien would say.
No, it's very, very much. It's very much a thumbs up. Again, double feature with Eddington. Watch them together at some point. You should do that because I feel like they are very much the two movies of our moment. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at the Dashery store. The Dashery store. Everybody loves Dashery, and you can buy a great T-shirt, and you can wear it to the meetup that's happening on Friday. Is that right?
Wednesday.
For subscribers?
Or Wednesday.
Paid subscribers.
Wednesday for subscribers. Sorry, Wednesday, not Friday. Wednesday. See, I won't be there. Maybe I can FaceTime in. Maybe I can send a text message video of myself to everybody. But
we'll,
you guys
we'll FaceTime in Sunny at the bar.
Good.
Let's put you on the big screen.
Nobody wants that. All right. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sunny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday, hopefully.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.